Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Tracy McClure. Coming up, we take an in-depth look at what motivated the UN's first member states to adopt the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and at what are the challenges facing that document today.
We begin today's program, however, with a look at Pope Benedict's Lenten message for 2009, which was released at a press conference on Tuesday. The message focuses this year on the theme of fasting and its spiritual importance in this season of Lent. Chris Altieri takes a closer look.
A panel of experts and church officials under the leadership of the president of the Pontifical Council Cor Unum, Cardinal Paul Joseph Cordes, presented the Holy Father's 2009 Lenten message on Tuesday at the press office of the Holy See. Pope Benedict this year chose to focus on the value and meaning of fasting, taking the scripture account of the Lord Jesus' 40 days fast before his temptation in the desert. The Pope writes that in our own day, fasting seems to have lost something of its spiritual meaning and has taken on, in a culture characterized by the search for material well-being, a therapeutic value for the care of one's body. Pope Benedict goes on to recognize the potential benefits to physical well-being that fasting might have and continues to clarify that for believers, fasting is in the first place a therapy to heal all that prevents them from conformity to the will of God. Pope Benedict also says fasting can bring an increase of sensitivity to the plight of those who are forced by circumstance to go without proper nourishment. In his message, the Holy Father says the ultimate goal of fasting is to help each one of us to make the complete gift of self to God. Pope Benedict prays that every family and Christian community use well this time of Lent in order to cast aside all that distracts the spirit and to grow in whatever nourishes the soul, moving it to love of God and neighbor. I'm Chris Altieri.
The Pope's Lenten message was presented at the press conference by Cardinal Paul Joseph Cordes, president of the Pope's charity organization Cor Unum. Also addressing that conference to give a very practical reflection on the importance of this message was the executive director of the World Food Programme, Josette Sheeran.
Serving the hungry is a moral call that unites people of all faiths. I would like to assure each and every person that when it comes to hunger, they can make a difference. Feeding the hungry is a profound act of love and restores dignity to a mother or father who cannot provide for a starving child. This is a critical moment. While all families must take some sacrifices during these economic hard times, for the poorest of the poor, this means going without meals for a day or two or three. If you can imagine, if you're living on less than $1 a day and the cost of commodities have doubled or your income gets cut, you're cutting out the basic nutrition for your children and family. This dramatic reduction in nutrition is particularly alarming for children under 2 years old, where we now know that nutritional deprivation will stunt their minds and bodies for life. Today, a child dies every 6 seconds from hunger. The question is there anything that can be done to alleviate the humiliation, pain, and injustice of hunger? Are there solutions that help people break the cycle of hunger for themselves, once and for all? The answer overwhelmingly is yes.
You were listening there to the executive director of the World Food Programme, Josette Sheeran, reflecting on the importance of Pope Benedict's Lenten message for 2009. Back now to Tracy McClure for her in-depth look at the Universal Declaration of Human Rights.
It is the first and perhaps the most important globally accepted document recognizing the dignity and rights of every man and woman. Pope John Paul II called it one of the highest expressions of the human conscience of our time. The Universal Declaration of Human Rights was adopted by the UN General Assembly in Paris in December 1948. The United States' Eleanor Roosevelt addressed the Assembly on December 9, 1948, urging the UN's 58 members to adopt the historic declaration.
Mr. President, the long and meticulous study and debate of which this Universal Declaration of Human Rights is the product means that it reflects the composite views of the many men and governments who have contributed to its formulation. Taken as a whole, the delegation of the United States believes that this is a good document, even a great document, and we propose to give it our full support. In giving our approval to the declaration today, it is of primary importance that we keep clearly in mind the basic character of the document. It is not a treaty, it is not an international agreement, it is not and does not purport to be a statement of law or of legal obligation. It is a declaration of basic principles of human rights and freedoms, to be stamped with the approval of the General Assembly by formal vote of its members, and to serve as a common standard of achievement for all peoples of all nations.
Pope Benedict XVI described the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, or UDHR, as the outcome of a convergence of different religious and cultural traditions, all of them motivated by the common desire to place the human person at the heart of institutions, laws, and the workings of society. Well, 48 member states ratified the declaration on December 10, 1948, among them 21 Latin American and Caribbean nations, 16 members from Europe, and 6 from Asia, including China, India, Burma, and the Philippines. Among those countries which abstained from the vote, the Soviet Union and a South Africa under apartheid. Of the 9 majority Muslim member countries, Afghanistan, Egypt, Iran, Iraq, Pakistan, Syria, Lebanon, and Turkey, Saudi Arabia was the single one to abstain. The first of the 30 articles outlined in the declaration reads, "All human beings are born free and equal in dignity and rights. They are endowed with reason and conscience and should act towards one another in a spirit of brotherhood." While representing Lebanon, Charles Malik was one of the chief drafters of the declaration. He described why UN member countries decided the time had come for a common position on human rights.
The phrase human rights and fundamental freedoms is mentioned 7 times in the Charter of the World Organization, but nowhere is it precisely defined. Just what are my basic rights and my irreducible freedoms as a man? This question is not answered. What we are trying to do in the declaration, which we have just half finished, is to enumerate in precise terms man's fundamental rights and freedoms. Thus, we state that you and I are born free and equal, that we are endowed with reason and conscience, that there should be no discrimination between men and women of all sorts and kinds, that no one shall be held in slavery or servitude, that no one shall be subjected to arbitrary arrest. We declare the right of asylum and the right of nationality. We declare the right of property, the right of marriage, the right to freedom of thought, freedom of conscience, and freedom of religion. We declare the right to freedom of assembly and association, the right to social security, to a decent standard of living, to education and leisure, and to the enjoyment of art and scientific advancement. The important thing in all this is that the declaration will be the outcome of the combined thought of 58 nations. It will therefore express the fundamental convictions of the present age with respect to what constitutes the dignity of man. It will be an international document of the first order of importance, and it will be read and pondered by our children's children.
But Malik's own child, Habib Malik, a historian with the Lebanese American University in Byblos today, wonders if threats to the UDHR will water down its impact by the time his own kids are grown.
It has become very fuzzy to determine legitimate claims for rights versus spurious ones. You have what I would call pseudo-minorities in society clamoring for very specific rights, and it can reach absurd proportions. I mean, think of, for example, the Flat Earth Society in Nevada, people who think this whole business of a round planet is a conspiracy. Well, you can have fun and be a part of that group, but to use that group as a minority that deserves rights becomes really absurd. And this is where we have reached. So yes, we have come a long way since 1948, when there was greater clarity on the substance of rights. There was a great consensus across national borders on what rights really are, and therefore a basis for their universality, versus a few decades later, where it had become fashionable to create rights cottage industries, as it were. We reach again the absurd point where something like abortion, which is plain murder of the unborn, the innocents, is hailed as a quote-unquote human right.
Professor Gene Elstein of the University of Chicago says this is a period of testing and peril for human rights.
We have strayed insofar as we believe that we can hold on to human rights if we enjoy them, but we can reject, at the same time, the grounds on which human rights were erected, namely an understanding of human dignity, an understanding of natural or human rights as God-given. Those were the strongest arguments made for why we have rights. And now, again, there are many who say those grounds were never coherent, that we can do without them and still have rights. That's one kind of argument that's being made today.
Monsignor James Reinert of the Pontifical Council for Justice and Peace is concerned that there are no effective means for implementing the Declaration.
There are 30 important factors, 30 important articles in the Universal Declaration. One of the key issues is at the very beginning, where it speaks of the dignity of the human being and the inherent rights that each person has. For us, and especially for the Holy Fathers, John Paul and Benedict, and all the way down through the ages, that we've talked about the human, our sharing in human dignity as the foundation for all of this. If there's a disappointment in the way that these things have been implemented and respected, it would be in that. The fact that people pick and choose the human rights that they will honor, but it's the lack of the recognition of human dignity that we've seen since the Declaration, but even before, and as a result of the wars and the conflicts that we've had, it's where the Declaration has come out of. But in these last 60 years, how many times have we seen genocide? How many times have we seen the respect of life put aside for something that someone else might consider even more important? For this office, those would be the two greatest disappointments. We also see at the same time how important the Declaration is for order and for bringing opportunity and dignity into the world for people.
The U.S. Ambassador to the Holy See, Marianne Glendon, agrees that the universal concept of human rights is at peril.
I do. I think that the peril, in a way, is a concomitant of the success of the human rights idea, that the more the idea showed its power, the more intense became the efforts to capture that power, and for various ends, not all of which are respectful of human dignity, which is, after all, the reed. Maybe it is a slender reed, but it is the reed on which the enterprise currently rests.
Well, that slender reed was supported by a majority of the world's nations back in 1948. I asked Habib Malik to take us back to his father's UN negotiating table.
When the Human Rights Commission began its work in 1947, the world was emerging from one of the bloodiest and worst horrors in human history, namely the Second World War. So right there in the immediate background were all of these horrors that someone had to react to. And in 1945, at the founding conference of the United Nations, the Charter of the United Nations mentions the need to develop a sense of human rights, which the United Nations acted upon a couple of years later with the Commission. So yes, it was a very special, unique moment, an exceptional moment, between, in a sense, the end of an awful horror, the Second World War, and the beginning of tense polarization in the world with the Cold War. And perhaps only at a moment like that, before the polarization and after the horrors, could the world come together briefly and honestly and formulate what can legitimately be claimed to be universal rights. That is the setting in which my father, my late father, Charles Malik, was operating. And he and a set of other very unique individuals from a number of countries rose to the occasion, as it were, seized the moment, and managed to hammer out a set of rights that can truly be claimed to be universal. In a sense, looking back on that year, 1948, at the proclamation of the Declaration, from our vantage point today, you almost feel like that moment has fallen through the cracks of history, in a sense. Before it were the horrors, after it was the polarization, and then so much has happened since then. And one wonders, you know, can we recapture the uniqueness of that moment? Can we somehow perpetuate the universal achievement at, you know, that was the Declaration at that time? And I think that the Declaration speaks for itself. The language is simple. People need to read it again. It is a remarkably modern, in fact, forward-looking document that has proven it transcends time and space.
How did those who actually drafted the Declaration ensure that it would be a universal declaration, a universal document?
Well, you know, they were preceded, the Human Rights Commission's work in 1947 was preceded by something very important, which is that a group of philosophers got together and put together a kind of generic questionnaire, which was then circulated globally to across cultures and boundaries in order to see if there is indeed a legitimate basis for thinking in terms of universal rights. And the response that came back was surprising, because in fact there emerged a considerable common ground about, you know, what about notions of right and wrong that cut across cultures and ideologies and religions. And so based on that encouraging, if you will, first sounding out through the UNESCO effort, it was done by UNESCO, and the philosopher's questionnaire, the commission felt emboldened to go ahead and work on universal rights. So that was really the setting, and I think that was a very important prerequisite, which indicated that indeed rights do have a universal basis, and that different peoples with different ideologies and different experiences historically often come to the same conclusion about right and wrong.
The document from its very inception was an impressively multicultural enterprise. I always say impressively, but imperfectly, because there were sections of the world that were still under colonial rule. But what did they do when they achieved independence? They adopted bills of rights, most of them modeled on the Universal Declaration. They signed the 1966 covenants affirming the Universal Declaration.
However, the Declaration has been fraught with criticism. One such complaint is that it fails to reflect the culture and beliefs of every nation.
That argument from cultural specificity is that in some cultures they don't have traditions of rights, that we should not try to impose rights on them, that rights are in fact are a Western imposition, and it is a kind of cultural imperialism. If we talk about violations of rights in cultures that have not historically generated such rights as part of their own tradition. This ignores, of course, the fact that for the last 50 years, people all over the world talk about rights and about violations of rights. So it ignores that and just claims they have a culturally specific way of doing things and we shouldn't interfere.
Iran, one of the original member states to adopt the declaration, now condemns it as an instrument of Western imperialism.
There was a period in the 1950s and 60s when this was a fashionable criticism. And I think if we analyze it historically, we see that it is tied in to a large extent with the dynamics of the Cold War and the grand ideological confrontation between communism and what was then called the free world. So, yes, inasmuch as you have third world countries, the so-called non-aligned movement, which eventually didn't turn out to be non-aligned at all, but actually a kind of a stage for Soviet propaganda, all of those quarters actually peddled this idea. Now, I think the fact that certain rights or certain values find fertile soil in a particular civilizational setting, let's say the West, to germinate and to thrive, that fact of birth or genesis does not in any way detract from their universality. And the more important question is, why is it that this particular set of rights found in the West and no other place the fertile soil in which to grow and develop? And that's a question that non-Westerners need to ask themselves. So, you know, I'm very skeptical about these labels of Western and so on. I think this diminishes rights. I think this is a false presentation and undermining of the inherent universality of human rights.
So the Western argument frequently, although not always, is something we hear from the world's worst human rights violators who really aren't worried about cultural patrimony as much as they are about pressures for political and civil liberty within their own people.
We can't talk about human rights if we don't agree that there is such a thing as human nature. And that's also part of the current, if you will, postmodern critique. But you know, the evidence is overwhelming that there is human nature, so that people shouldn't feel compelled to defend that. The onus of disproving that is on the shoulders of those who deny it.
Is there a difference? Do you make a distinction between man's nature and the divine?
Well, according to the Judeo-Christian tradition, man is created in the image of God. And therefore, there is something divine in man. And if you think about it in the fascinating terms of Eastern Orthodox theology, theosis is what is often referred to here. God became man through the incarnation so that man is divinized. In other words, so that man is allowed a second chance to fulfill that divine spark that God put in him as part of his nature, but which was, of course, corrupted and undermined by the free choice of sin and fallenness. So yes, from a Judeo-Christian perspective, human nature mirrors the nature of God, and there's a divine element in man that was put there, but that has been covered with layers of corruption and sin, hence the need for redemption. And it has been proven time and time again that man cannot pull himself up alone by his bootstraps. So God has to stretch his hand out and help man, and he has done so through his Son.
Religious freedom is considered one of the essential, fundamental human rights. Most of the rights, if not all, outlined in the Declaration for Human Rights are ensured by the Judeo-Christian tradition. Does that make it a religious document or a document based on Christianity or the Judeo-Christian tradition?
Again, the fact that these rights found a certain specific soil in which they naturally germinated and grew does not make them only the sole possession of that particular culture or civilization. So that would be part of my answer. Now, as far as religious freedom is concerned, the objections to that have really come from specific religious traditions that have found in Article 18 of the Universal Declaration, which is the religious freedom article, some problems specifically as far as the right to change one's religion is concerned. And I'm thinking mainly of the Islamic tradition and more specifically of Saudi Arabia, because there are many Muslim countries that actually voted for the declaration back in 1948 and were not in any way put off by this particular article. But Saudi Arabia was, and the last minute they changed their intended negative vote to an abstention, which was very fortuitous. But unfortunately, Saudi behavior since then, because of this lingering sense in Wahhabi thinking, which is the dominant version of Islam in Saudi Arabia, that in fact there are elements in this document that are alien to the Islamic tradition. I strongly believe that if the Universal Declaration contains rights that found a home, if you will, to germinate in the Judeo-Christian context, that is simply a reflection of the universality of the Judeo-Christian message, and not the other way around, that in fact these rights are purely and only Judeo-Christian.
Professor Elstein says it's time for Europeans to take stock of the last 60 years and reverse what she sees as a disturbing trend in the battle for human rights.
Well, I think it's a time of danger, in part because the very place where human rights originated, rights were elaborated, rights were defended, rights were articulated, namely Western Europe, and then, of course, made their way to the United States. That's where we find an abandonment of the tradition that gave rise to these rights, namely the Christian tradition. And to the extent that Christianity in Western Europe is abandoned and the notion of human dignity as God-given that goes with it, then I think we are in peril of losing much of what created Western culture, made it such a rich and such a great culture and tradition. And that's something that's very sad for those of us who are children of the West. It's a very sad moment. Another peril for human rights, obviously, is the fact that we still haven't quite figured out a way to enforce rights in situations where they're being systematically violated by a state that says, you can't interfere, I'm a state, I can do things the way I want. So we're still struggling with what we can do in those circumstances.
Jean Elstein is professor of social and political ethics at the University of Chicago. Also contributing to this program, historian Habib Malik from the Lebanese American University in Byblos, the U.S.'s ambassador to the Holy See, Marianne Glendon, and Monsignor James Reinert of the Pontifical Council for Justice and Peace. And that concludes today's program. Thanks for listening. I'm Tracy McClure.
You've been listening to the English program of Vatican Radio. Laudator Jesus Christus.